iTunes International. Virus free.
Around the world and down your street.
This is Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia, and I'm joined by John Press in the beautiful, beautiful Gold Coast in Queensland here in Australia. John, welcome to our show.
Oh, thanks very much for having me on, Henry. I'm very much appreciated.
Yes, and it's interesting because you actually contacted me about doing this interview.
That's great.
I feel that you wanted to spread the word on this.
Well, yeah, I wanted to talk about depression and how about one in five people get affected by depression, and what are some of the things that cause it, and how do I overcome it relatively easily.
Can I ask you, do you consider it to still be a taboo subject?
Yeah, any mental illness is a taboo subject. I've had a twofold thing, depression and schizophrenia, and I've lost, by being open and honest, I've lost friends through being that, telling people. It's very sad that that people act the way they do.
Possibly because maybe they don't understand. You mentioned to me that you consider depression to be the curse of society. You've also mentioned that a fifth of the population of this country, Australia, suffer depression. That seems like an alarmingly large amount of people.
Well, it's not just depression, it's mental illness such as schizophrenia, bipolar disease, and other things like that. And sort of mental illness.
I just should let our listeners know that you and I worked together back over 20 years ago in Sydney. And I want to talk about when you originally discovered that you had depression.
Well, I only really discovered I had depression 4 years ago when I was doing a Diploma of Community Services and going on discussing a subject on depression or mental illness, and I realised that I did suffered from some of the classic symptoms of depression, such as lack of interest in life, feeling down for 2 weeks, low self-esteem, lack of enjoyment in life. Anyone can be suffered from things, and like depression can be caused by many factors, such as watching too much TV or news on TV and negative people, just to give you an example of a couple. For me, my depression goes back to when I was five, when my father died, and growing up with an alcoholic mother.
Did you not realise what it was at that age? Obviously, five is way too young to really understand, but as the years went on, because you mentioned it's 4 years ago when you were studying that you realised that you had depression, but you must have felt, as you grew, you must have felt that there was something wrong, even though you may not have known what it was.
That's correct. I did feel something was wrong, such as inability to love properly another human being, such as my wife. And I went, when I separated from my first wife, I went, I took responsibility and went to the special psychic counsellor, and she went right back to my youth and various issues and things like that. But she didn't discuss that or say that I was depressed. I only, as I said before, I only found out 4 years ago.
That's amazing when you think about it. Because.
Well, I'm 63 now.
You're 63 now, you young fella. So it does amaze me. I guess times have changed, and organisations like Beyond Blue here in Australia are helping a lot of people. Maybe, you know, back in the 70s, there wasn't enough help around, and maybe not enough awareness around.
Well, I think there's a better awareness, whether or not Beyond Blue really helps people, or they're just that big company like Qantas out there beating the drum. Really, if I've got a few people who are friends and they're more heavily depressed than I am, and I try to get them to seek help or talk to me about it, because I've put in place things within myself, such as learning to love yourself by looking in the mirror. What other things? Writing positive affirmations, getting a network of friends, music. And basically, you've got to take responsibility for your actions. That today, from today, anything I do tomorrow is my responsibility. You can't go back and say, oh, because of my father died when I was five, or my mother was an alcoholic or anything like that. You just got to take responsibility and get on with life.
I want to talk about your childhood. You mentioned, you know, your family problems as a very young man, I guess. Have you? And you also mentioned that you can't blame these things because you basically have to be accountable for yourself. When you started, before you really knew what was wrong with you, if that's a term that I probably shouldn't use, what was afflicting you, I should say, did you kind of like do anything about it? Did you seek help at any point before recently?
When I really went on with life, plodding along, making mistakes. And when I was about 21, I suffered from a schizophrenic attack. But I've had the twofold schizophrenia and depression.
Right. And let's talk about this, the symptoms of depression. And it's really a double whammy when you've got schizophrenia as well. Tell me how schizophrenia affects you.
Well, you're delusional. For me, it only happens, say, once every 5 years, you become delusional. The world's unreal to you. You start doing silly things. And the only way you end up getting hospitalised and given force-fed medication. And then if you get hospitalised too many times, like me, you get on a lifetime medication, which I've just come off with, a drug called Xolian. All the time the doctors are trying to keep you on medication, and family members think drugs are the panacea of solving problems rather than the management of the problem, such as good eating, a healthy lifestyle, keeping away from negative things, and so on and so forth.
How does it affect your sleep? How does it affect your sleep?
Well, I take a drug called quetiapine for sleep, because that's one of the major factors. I couldn't do night shift or anything like that. A few years ago, I had a problem where a friend had a hire car business, and I was helping him out because he got sick, and I got a bit sick myself because of that. I wasn't delusional or anything like that, but I just, mind started racing and things. My wife sort of saw factors that alerted her to a possible problem.
Your first wife, did she end the relationship or did you?
She ended the relationship. She found another boyfriend because she couldn't deal with the schizophrenia I had. Even though I only had it once every 5 or 10 years, she stressed about it and then couldn't deal with it and found solace in another man.
Right. And how did you, I mean, this is probably a rhetorical question, but how did you respond, given your condition? How did you respond to this? How bad was it for you?
It was bad in that we had a house together, which had to be sold. Being in a house for 18 years, you have a lot of love for the house and the stable surroundings. And once the stability of the house was gone, the wife was gone, I just packed my bags and went and lived in the Philippines for 2 years.
And when was that?
Back in 2006. Oh, it was more like 3 years.
Did you have children with your first wife?
Yeah, one child, yeah.
And how did the child react to you guys separating? And what age was this child?
He found it quite difficult and need to go to have counselling and things like that.
And is he okay now?
Yeah, he's fine. He's married and got two kids and getting on with life.
to catch the deluge in a paper cup. There's a battle ahead. Many battles are lost, but you'll never see the end of the road while you're traveling with me.
Bondi Tunes International is everywhere.
This is language educator Carl Cotter in Spain.
This is Don Drost in Orlando, Florida.
I'm Henry for Bondi Tunes International in Sydney.
This is Ling Pang, UK correspondent for Bondi Tunes International.
Declan Hughes in Dublin.
I am the political correspondent, Adam Devlin, in Melbourne.
I'm Joe Volta.
And I'm Paul Volta.
Reporting from Tasmania.
Thomas Booker, South Central United States correspondent for Bondi Tunes.
Ronan Seagrave in Canada.
Entertainment reporter Rachel Branson in Melbourne.
I'm Lindsay Dolan for Bondi Tunes International in Dublin, Ireland.
Bondi Tunes International is everywhere. You mentioned to me that depression can lead to other problems, as in alcoholism. Have you had other problems such as alcoholism?
For a while in my life, I was drinking a lot of alcohol back in the days of TNT and things like that.
Yeah.
But I was in the Philippines and I couldn't get – I wasn't your normal alcoholic or anything like that. I couldn't get a certain type of beer, and I didn't like the draft beer, the San Miguel draft beer, so I just stopped drinking.
Really? So, that's a funny reason.
It's sort of like you like your wine, and if you can't get a certain wine and the other wine doesn't taste so good, you tend not to I
would say everyone would agree with you on that one. Some people just want to drink. So you don't drink anymore, is that right?
No, I have a glass of red or two at night and maybe a beer occasionally, but that's about it. My days of heavy drinking are over.
Was heavy drinking, again, another rhetorical question, was heavy drinking badly affecting you?
Not really, no. I don't think it was badly affecting, other than the fact that I used to get home about 7 o'clock at night and probably affected the family and that I wasn't spending enough time with my son and things like that. But he did a lot of sport, and I had to drive him around a lot, so we spent a lot of time together.
And you're obviously still in contact and all that sort of stuff?
Yes, I am, yeah.
Now, you mentioned earlier on that you sound like you don't have a lot of confidence in organisations like Beyond Blue. Is that across the board for you? Do you think that these... You mentioned that they're like a big corporation of sorts. Jeff Kennett, who used to be the premier of the state of Victoria here in Australia, suffered depression. He said that he'd get up at 7 in the morning. He had a very busy job running a state. And he said for the first 5 hours of being awake, he was in depression mode and he kind of lifted at around midday. Did you find, or do you find, when you have these bouts of depression, that it's hard to get out of bed?
No, it's never been hard to get out of bed. Just force yourself to get out of bed. You get through the day. You take one task at a time, however hard it is. One of the major changes I've seen in myself is that instead of hating the job you go to, you sort of turn it into loving the job you go to, which if you love going to work, then that's half the battle won.
Yeah, absolutely. So did you seek counselling for this?
Yeah, I've been to psychologists and psychiatrists. I don't recommend psychiatrists because all they want to do is give you pills.
Yeah.
And once you're on pills, they don't want to take you off them.
Do you think that the medical industry is in bed with the pharmaceutical industry? Do you think they're all just selling this stuff to make money and giving patients these drugs because of money?
Well, it's too easy to give people drugs, and the doctors may be in bed with the pharmaceutical industries. Well, when you look at some of these drugs, the price of them, you tend to think so. I mean, it's that there is a connection. You can pull the dots. I mean, no one. Maybe I'm a bit revolutionary in the way I think, but you can manage your illness with cooperation with other people, not being around negative people, trying to be with positive people that understand you, talking about it, and making an effort.
So it's like a holistic approach, really, isn't it?
That's correct. Yeah, you've got to take a holistic approach and turn your life around. If every day you get out of the bed the same way and you don't change something, you've got to change things in your life, and you've got to look at things through different glasses, so to speak. So look at life through a different viewpoint and start to be happy.
You talk about making changes. You moved to the Philippines. Did you work in the Philippines?
No, I was a tourist there for 3 years.
Oh, my God.
I sold the house we lived in and had a fair bit of money, so I went over there having a good time and found a woman and got married and had a daughter over there.
Yes, I want to ask you about that because this is obviously where you met your current wife. You had a daughter over in the Philippines.
That's correct, yeah. She's now 12.
Oh, right. And you have another child as well.
Yeah, JV 8 and my son 33.
Oh, I see. That's from the previous marriage. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you find it, you were in the Philippines for quite a long time. Did you find it difficult to adjust back to Australia? And also, did your now wife have problems coming into this country?
dealing with immigration is a very lengthy process, and I wouldn't wish it on anyone, honestly. There's just so much paperwork and so much rigmarole goes on. When we immigrated, it cost about $4,000.
Mm-hmm.
And when my now, it cost about $8,000.
Right.
And
did she get residency in this country?
No, she's an Australian citizen now.
Oh, good. Good stuff.
It took 4 years. So she took 2 years to become an Australian resident.
Hmm.
And then from there, another 2 years. So 4 years maximum before she can become an Australian citizen. And now she's her and Sam Australian citizens.
What do you think now? How do you see the future? Is the future bright for you and your wife and your child?
Yeah, I think so. I don't see any major issues. My wife likes to work and I'm semi-retired and my daughter's doing well at school and my younger daughter, she just plods along and she's happy with things. So, yeah, there's no major worries. And
you live on the Gold Coast. I mean, when I knew you, you lived in Sydney, obviously, because we both worked at the freight company. Yeah. What made you go? By the way, if you've just joined us, I'm about to finish this interview with John, but John and I worked at TNT in 1990 or thereabouts, 89, 1991 maybe. I just wonder why you went, our listeners are mostly in Europe. If they come to Australia, especially if they're on a one-year visa, young folks, they will know Bondi Beach, where I live, and they will know the Gold Coast, where you live, because in winter, what the young people do, gets cold in Sydney, in mid-July or whatever, and they zoom up to Queensland, and they go to the Gold Coast. What is it that you like about the Gold Coast?
It's a very laid-back sort of way of life. You don't have to put shoes on every day. You wear thongs.
Yeah.
You wear shorts. But three quarters of the year and T-shirt, you don't have to generally dress up very to do anything. And I like the laid-back attitude. I like the it's sunny most of the time, so you get generally get a good dose of vitamin D.
Of course, when
the Gold Coast is a changing place. Compared with when I came here in 1963 to the Gold Coast, when we immigrated from New Zealand, and we stayed about 3 or 4 years here, and then we went to my mother was taking us back to New Zealand, and we got stuck in Sydney. So I was in Sydney for 35 years.
Right. Okay. Well, look, John, it's so good to talk to you after all this time. Thank you so much for joining me here on Bondi Tunes International. Can you just stay on the line?
Yeah, I can do. No problem.
That's John Press in Queensland. If you or anyone in your family or friends suffer depression, simply Google the word depression help. And Google will localize the search in your country. This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio. Hello there, this is Henry for Bondi Tunes International in Australia. A big shout out to all our listeners to Veterans Families Radio in the UK. Each week we do a 2-hour chat show where I chat to some of our 22 correspondents in 7 countries around the world. From Israel to Canada to the UK to Ireland to India, the sun never sets on Bondi Tunes International, and we are delighted to be on Veterans Families Radio.
From Australia, this is Bondi Tunes.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now
Bondi Tunes International, virus-free.
Around the world and down your street.
This is Bondi Tunes International broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia. Now, Felicity Carter is a good friend of mine, and that's the important part. She's also editor-in-chief of Meininger's Wine Business International and joins me now from the beautiful town of Neustadt near Frankfurt in Germany. Welcome to our broadcast, Felicity.
Good morning, Henry.
In all the years I've known you, you've been to our place in Australia, we've been to your place in Germany, I never knew that you had porridge for breakfast. And that's because I didn't get up in time in the morning.
That's right. If you would roll out of bed, you would know that, Henry.
Yep. Someday this will happen. Now, we all are being told that Germany is doing really well with this virus thing. What's going on in your neck of the woods?
Well, first of all, I live in a country town in southwest Germany, which is on the border near France. And it's a very warm area and it attracts a lot of retirees. The average age of my town is about 103, I think. So if anywhere was going to get swept by this virus, it would be this town. But in fact, we've been pretty free of it. In the earliest day, they built a field hospital and they called on retired medical staff to go and staff it. But it turned out not to be needed. So we've come out of this almost unscathed.
It's an unusual story, I guess. You know, I think Germany has come out not unscathed, but is doing very well along with Australia, New Zealand and some other countries. Sweden went a bit bonkers. they didn't bother with social distancing. They're paying the price now. What is it like? I mean, I've been to Neustadt. It's a beautiful town. You know the square where you, of course, you know the square where you live. What was it like during the lockdown? And was there really a lockdown? Because I've got a friend who lives in northern New South Wales here in Australia. And he said, what lockdown? Everything's open.
We did have a lockdown, but it was a sort of modified lockdown. So German police are very careful not to behave, not to overstep their boundaries because of the history here, as opposed to friends of mine who were in France who could be arrested and fined if they, you know, stepped outside their front door. So the idea was that you were supposed to stay home. The businesses were closed except for food businesses, and you were allowed out to walk the dog or exercise. And in fact, there were quite a number of people out and about. And then they gradually started lifting it a couple of weeks ago. I went to work through the whole period. So at my company, they wanted one person from every department on site. So what we've done is everything has changed. So at work, we have disinfectant as soon as you walk in through the door. There's signs everywhere. There's way more disinfectants and soap in the bathroom. At businesses, all the Perspex shields began to go up, so there's a lot of Perspex between you and the next person. In some of the smaller shops, it was homemade. They just got rolls of clear plastic and started running them down from the ceiling. And now everything is pretty much open, so it's almost normal. It's not quite normal. It's almost normal. People started to go back to the bars and restaurants immediately. But, of course, the tables are further apart. The servers all wear masks. You have to wear a mask if you get up to go to the toilet, and there's fewer tables and seats inside all of these places. So the question is, will the restaurants and cafes be able to survive? Even though a lot of people have gone back, there's less, you know, they're seating less customers than they were in the past.
Sorry, Felicity, I just want to let our listeners know there's a lot of roadworks going on outside my window, so I apologise for the sound of that. You know, I mentioned that, you know, Neustadt is near Frankfurt. A lot of small towns had an influx here in Australia, people fleeing the cities. Did you get any of that in Neustadt?
Not that I'm aware of. I think it would be very unlikely. I mean, there was a huge amount of confidence here early on because Angela Merkel is, you know, she's a scientist, she's a trained scientist, and she was very calm. And she, every time something would happen, she would come out and she would give a speech where she was very calm about it. She explained what was happening. She didn't lie. She didn't hold anything back. She explained every step of the way why the government was doing what it was doing. I mean, it's not all been smooth sailing in Germany. There's been a huge amount of anger, particularly from business owners and from people who lost their jobs about, you know, the economic devastation that this virus has brought. And in some ways, the more the government saved lives, the more people questioned whether it was actually necessary, because nobody's seeing, you know, dead bodies in the street or you know, chaos in the medical system. And so a lot of people were like, well, was it really necessary what we did?
You're a broadcaster. Can't remember the name of it, actually. You're a national broadcaster over there. Do you think that they're being honest with... Is the media in general in Germany being honest with people? The reason I ask this question is because there's been a lot of... Again, I need to refer to Australia. And by the way, you will have noticed that Felicity is from Australia. I should have mentioned that, but we didn't need to, really, did we? There's a lot of misinformation going on in the media with regard to... here in Australia, of course, it's down to states, as you know. And each state makes its own decisions. One state says the kids can go back to school. Another state says, no, they can't. And just this week, as we record, the schools were forced open in New South Wales, and two children from two different schools were testing positive to the virus, both in the eastern suburbs here in Sydney. With Germany, it's a one state, like same decision for everyone, yeah?
No, we've got 16 states in Germany. It's a federation like Australia, and so different states are doing their own thing, basically. Some states had tighter lockdowns than others. Some opened up much earlier. That's not a decision taken at the federal level.
Ah, okay. I did not know this. So basically, everyone makes their own... See, I find this very confusing. Here in Australia, it's just been so confusing for people because they've been told different things every day by different states, and people really don't know what the hell they're doing or what they're supposed to do. And you know, Australians are generally very good. They do what they're told by the government. In my experience of this in 30 years in Australia, and you can choose to agree or disagree with that, but I'd like to ask about the wine industry. Now, you're in the wine industry... I'm in the wine industry. Our good, my partner, which is a good friend of yours, obviously, is also in the wine industry. What I noted at the beginning of the so-called shutdown is that a lot of people were buying a lot more alcohol. Okay. There was a surge in this, Felicity.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. We've at work, we've been trying to track internationally what's going on. And we've certainly seen from the big retailers and anybody with an established online shop that their sales have been colossal. You know, from in the first week in Italy, you know, the online sellers were seeing rises in 240%, 280%. In some places, they've been as high as 700%. But here's the problem. Retailers only represent a relatively small part of the wine market. A lot of wine is sold in restaurants in what's called the on-trade, or it's sold in what's called catering, so things like airlines. And all of that shut down. So it seems internationally that the rise in people buying online has not offset the losses in the on-trade, which is really interesting and unfortunate. So there's a lot of wineries around the world that are really feeling the pain because they weren't selling to the big retailers or they weren't selling to the big online markets. So what's happening internationally is wineries around the world are scrabbling as fast as they can to put on what's called DTC, direct to consumer. They're trying to put on their own web shops and stuff. It's probably too late for some of them. I think we'll start to see some bankruptcies amongst some small wineries, and that's true around the world.
Is there a return to normalcy with regard to this industry? You know, here when this kind of crazy buying of alcohol in general, and by the way, here in Australia, something like 122,000 barrels of beer had to be thrown out. I'm as a beer drinker, I'm brokenhearted, I must say.
How terrible, that's a tragedy.
I asked about normalcy returning with regard to your industry. Now, as we said in the intro, you are the editor-in-chief of Meininger's Wine Business International. You run magazines and that kind of thing. How have your sales been going? Is it electronic? Excuse my ignorance. I don't know exactly how you do this. Are your magazines...
We've got a combination of print and digital. What we've seen generally, and this is true across the media, is up until recently, anything that you wrote that wasn't about the pandemic didn't really get read. People weren't in the mind frame for reading anything, unless it was cute and funny. Our readership has gone up like everybody else. One of the awful things about the media is what we've seen internationally again is that more people are glued online than ever. Readership numbers are going up, but advertising has collapsed. So we're in the middle of a massive collapse of media. We're seeing even really big marquee names like The Economist, The Financial Times, The Guardian are starting to lay off staff, even though, and this is the paradox, more people are reading and paying for it than ever before. It's a tragedy. And the question is, can we come back from this? And that's up in the air at the moment.
What an interesting mix of circumstances. Readership goes up, subscriptions go up, but advertising goes down. Are you kind of like in the same place as you were before the pandemic, if you just balance everything out?
No. Unfortunately, the media model has always been based on advertising revenue. And in the last few years, people have begun to realise that your true customer as a media person is the reader, it's not the advertiser. And so there's been a scramble to try and reorient towards subscribers. And that's why all over the world you've seen paywalls go up, you're seeing less quality information that's available for free. And it was really starting to pay off. The New York Times, I think, is already profitable just on its digital subscriptions, and The Guardian was certainly going that way. But the change didn't happen fast enough for the pandemic. And when the pandemic happened, economic activity stopped. So all the advertising just stopped at once. And it's been too much for the media. We're going to see a lot of collapses happening.
Yep. And you know, I keep using the word normalcy, not just within our industry, but within every industry. Do you think that the Germans are very good at social distancing?
No, they're very terrible.
Really?
I've read all these racist comments, and they are racist comments from people talking about, you know, the fact that Germany didn't have these high pandemic numbers. And what a lot of people invariably say is they say, oh, Germans are very good at following orders, which is really racist. It comes from the Second World War stereotype. But in actual fact, Germans are hopeless at this. The thing that they cannot do under any circumstances is queue. It just offends everything about them not to sort of push into line. And so they're really, really terrible at social distancing. And even though now to get into the shops, you're only allowed to have two people at a time. So the rest of you have to queue in the street. And there are these markers to show you where to queue. So the whole street looks like a crime scene, basically, because they've used the crime scene tape. And still, you can't tell who's queuing and who's just hanging around checking their phone. And so every day there's people telling you off for being in front of them, or, oh, it's terrible. No, Germans are hopeless at social distancing.
When does lockdown started here in Bondi in Sydney, I was going to the chemist and I was stopped by a policeman.
Oh my God.
And he said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to the chemist. And he says, why? Now, that's a weird question to be asked.
That's police overreach. That's outrageous.
It's also illegal, I found out. You know, the only thing you can ask someone on the street if you're a cop, unless you've got other reasons, is their name and address. Anyway, it was all a bit mad here for a while, and you may have heard Bondi Beach at the beginning of this close down. The backpackers all flooded out to the beach and broke all the rules. And 28 backpackers from all over the world, mostly South America, I do believe, got the virus. So then they shut down the beach, and then they reopened the beach 4 weeks later, I think. And that was all good to go. You were allowed to surf. And if you're actually on the sand of the beach, you're allowed to only four people. If you're on the grass, you're only allowed to stand. I mean, I talked about the confusion of what the state governments are doing, and particularly councils in the eastern suburbs of New South Wales. No wonder people are confused. They've been told to do so many different things. But it sounds like, you know, people are not being as well behaved as they're expected to be in Germany.
Well, no. In fact, there've been, there've been fierce demonstrations by people who, are really opposed to the lockdown, just like there have been in America. And what we're seeing, which is really concerning, is there's this sort of toxic joining of different groups. So you've got the anti-vaxxers who have got these conspiracy theories that a vaccine is going to be used to control us all. And then you've got them joining up with people who are sort of generally conspiracy-minded anyway, which, you know, in Europe can be really ugly in terms of anti-Semitism and stuff. And then you've got people who are sort of economic libertarians who don't want the shutdowns. And so this really sort of nasty new politics of conspiracy theories is beginning to enter the mainstream in a very, very worrying way.
Yeah, and it's it's interesting. Again, you know, I want to ask you, if protesting in Germany is a physical thing, is it a violent thing? You know, going back to what we were saying, that Germans...
That is very German. It's very organised. So if you want to protest, you're allowed to do it. But what you have to do is you have to tell the police that you're about to go and protest or you're about to hit the streets. And there's no problem. They'll let you do that. So it's so they can get organised and have a police presence and all of those sorts of things. There have been some very nasty incidents in Germany. I think there was one in, I think it was Frankfurt or somewhere, where people ended up throwing stones at the cops. I think a lot of this is because, like you said, it's the lack of certainty. And one of the problems, of course, is that nobody knew what this virus was. They didn't know if it was the Black Death, or they didn't know if it was just a seasonal flu type of thing. And from the beginning, China didn't give the right signals. So China was saying it's no big deal, but at the same time, they locked down a city of 10 million people. So the world kind of looked at that and said, well, this thing must be really, really bad. And reacted accordingly. But as new information came to light, some people were like, well, maybe it's not that bad, maybe it is that bad. Now it's showing different symptoms in children. So it's not that people have been disorganized or giving us bad information. It's because the thing itself is unknown, and information about it keeps changing. And I think that's what's leading to some of the chaos. But of course, there's a lot of people that don't understand that public health officials are grappling with incomplete information. They see it in terms of conspiracy theories. But then on the other hand, we've also seen around the world, we've seen people using this as an excuse to grab police powers and political powers. There's been some really bizarre police overreach in all sorts of places. Like, you know, in Italy, the police checking what people bought in their supermarket baskets and taking their flipping wine out as being unnecessary. You know, that's just total police overreach.
Yes, and drunk police afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
Second wave, Chancellor Angela Merkel, does she talk, and does the administration there talk of a second wave, as in maybe COVID-20? I mean, here in Australia, Scott Morrison, our Prime Minister, is saying is that there will be a second wave, but we're going to be prepared for this time as he reopens businesses and schools and that kind of thing. Is there preparation for a second wave in Germany that you know of, or are they just pretending that's not going to happen?
I mean, the World Health Organization came out yesterday and said the world needed to be prepared for a second wave. Now, nobody knows if this is actually going to happen. A lot of this is based on what happened in 1918 with the Spanish flu, which was that the first wave was pretty bad, but it was really the second wave that killed most people. It's not necessarily true that we will get a second wave. It's one of these things that nobody knows what's going to happen, and so everybody's getting prepared for the worst case scenario.
Yes, a very good point with regard to, you know, people are looking back instead of forward because they've got nowhere to look forward because they don't know what's going to happen. Finally, Felicity, do you still call Australia a home? You've been in Germany quite a while, and of course I've known you for 20 years.
The lockdown made me feel more Australian than ever, because normally in my job I travel quite a lot and, I'm always at the airport every couple of weeks, and I go places and see people. And so this was the longest time that I'd actually stayed in Neustadt. So I was here, not going anywhere else. And it was absolutely suffocating knowing that it's one thing when you know you can leave, but once the airspace shut down in Australia, realizing that I couldn't get home, and how that made me realize that I'm Australian in my soul, and I want to come home.
That's a beautiful thing. I did mean to ask you about traveling. I know you travel a lot around Europe for your job, and it must have been quite a shocker for you. You're not stuck in a big city, and I don't think it matters to you.
I'm stuck in a very small town.
I've spoken to a lot of people on this broadcast, and they do say, you know, at the start it was kind of scary, and then it was bearable, and now I like it. I like this. And a lot of people, such as my partner, one of your best friends, is working in a bedroom converted into her office, which a space you know so well. She's sort of thinking, this is not bad, because she just WhatsApps me because I'm near the kitchen if she wants a coffee. So this is true. She's probably about to WhatsApp me now. If she wants a coffee, I bring it in. It's a bit like room service. But a lot of people just to make my point, is that a lot of people got used to this, and many actually like it. And I think it's possible that a lot of these companies are going to be saying, do you want to stay at home?
Yeah, well, there's a whole lot of issues around it, which is really interesting. In Germany, they're thinking about bringing into law that you have the right to work from home. I've worked remotely with people for more than 10 years now. With the magazine, I've got 30 freelancers all over the world. And I have to say, it's not as easy as people think it is. There's a lot of value in getting together and talking things through. And when you're away from other people for too long, it can be very alienating. You know, if you're always looking at people through Zoom or through email, you don't always get the nuances of things. It's very easy to get misunderstandings, and it can be very lonely. However, if we do move that, there's already moves afoot to make your employer pay for part of your rent.
That's a good
thing.
Because
if your home is your place of business, then you know that your employer is getting a benefit from your bricks and mortar. I know from talking to business people that a lot of businesses are rethinking how much business travel they do, which is good for the environment. Mm. It's not good for airlines because most of their lucrative section of their business comes from business travelers. So I think there's a whole rethinking of, you know, of this and going digital. I will say I'm not sure that we truly understand the implications of what digital is doing to us. So, for example, we know that people who are talking on Zoom often feel exhausted after they get off because they're not getting all of the normal human signals that they would if they were sitting in person. So it's a sort of it's a mock-up of a human conversation, but it doesn't quite work that. And so people are finding that they're uncharacteristically tired afterwards. And I think there's a whole lot of things like that are sort of the hidden side of constantly being in a virtual world that we haven't really had a reckoning with yet.
That's something I did not think about, that you can actually get tired from talking through an electronic medium rather than being in a room with body language, and a lot has to be said for body language when you're doing business meetings and that kind of thing.
National Geographic did a really interesting article about this, about what you lose when you're looking at somebody through a pixelated screen, and a lot of the emotional cues and the sort of the human cues that you lose. You know, the idea that kids are going to move online to do their education, I think, is very, very worrying. I think it will shortchange kids if we force them to stare at screens all day. Because your brain works in different ways when you work digitally. And I'm not sure we understand the implications of all of that.
That is fascinating. No one's come up with that before. That's really interesting stuff. Felicity, I know you've got a busy day ahead. It's 25 past 8 in the morning there. It's 25 past 4 in the afternoon in Sydney, Australia. Felicity Carter, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, Henry. It's always a pleasure.
This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio.
Syndicated into Europe from Sydney, Australia. This is Bondi Tunes.
Bondi Tunes. Playing all over the planet now!
The Rolling Stones, Satisfaction. The song is considered to be one of the all-time great rock songs. In 2004, Rolling Stone magazine placed Satisfaction in the second spot on its list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. So, who would try and improve on this classic recording? Britney Spears.
Britney Spears? Pull the other leg, it's got bells on.
Britney Spears.
You've got to be kidding.
Can't get no satisfaction.
Unfortunately, no.
No satisfaction, and I try.
Thank you.
Henry O'Donovan.